Now, workplaces are looking to hire in the midst of a big labor shortage, and that's leading them to offer perks like hiring bonuses and more flexible work arrangements. But is the new leverage that workers have on the job market turning into actual power inside of companies? Our next guests say no, but that could change if workers get a say in company decision-making. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you wish you had more say in how decisions are made where you work? What sort of changes would you push for if you did? If you work in management of some sort, what do you make of the idea of sharing decision-making power with employees? Have you ever worked for a co-op of some sort? What did you think about how that worked? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Titiana Casciaro is a professor of organizational behavior and HR management at the University of Toronto, and Juliet Badalana is professor of organizational behavior and social innovation at Harvard University. They wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post titled, "No, the pandemic hasn't given workers more power, but that could change." They've got a new book out tomorrow. It's called Power for All: How It Really Works and Why It's Everyone's Business. Titiana, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having us.
And Julie, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Titiana, workers are in high demand right now. That's letting them ask sometimes for more money or maybe more work flexibility. Why isn't that, as you see it, translating into more power for workers?
Well, to know the answer requires understanding what power is. Power comes from having control over resources that people value. And there is no doubt when there's a labor shortage, the worker has control over a resource that a company values greatly, which is their labor. But once they join an organization, there are many, many decisions that really affect how the worker experiences being in that workplace that often employees have no control over. There are decisions about who else is hired, who is fired, who is promoted, how much autonomy you have in carrying out your job. Those are things that are very important to people. And the fact that they receive the bonus in this moment of great demand to join an organization does not at all mean that they can control those internal inner workings of the company they've joined.
And Julie, it may sound odd for Americans to think of employees having a lot of input into decision-making in companies, but in your op-ed, you write that that's actually the norm for many companies in places like Germany. Can you talk about how things work there?
You're right, absolutely. So the critical question, as Titiana mentioned, is for how can we get organized so that employees can have a real say in their company's decisions? And if you look at what's happening in Europe and you turn to the German model, then you get to see that indeed it is possible for employees to have a seat at the table and to participate in all the decisions that are made on the board. So let me tell you a bit more about this German co-determination model. Right. It actually was implemented following the Second World War in Germany. And what it does is that it gives employees the right to have board level representation. And what's interesting about this model is that it has now spread to countries across Europe, you know, to Austria, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, among other countries. And so what happened in these countries is that employees have a real say. They are not only consulted through surveys, they are not only consulted when critical issues emerge, they are represented and they participate together with the top management and the shareholders in the critical decisions that also affect their lives at work and beyond.
And Titiana, I can imagine a business owner or corporate board member or something saying, hang on, if I want to make a quick decision, but I have to go through the employee boards first. I don't know. Isn't this going to slow things down? Isn't this going to bring things to a halt at a business? What would you say to them?
Oh, that's the go-to response of a lot of executives who have no interest even in hearing from their team sometimes. They say, well, I can't really bring out all of this input from all of my teammates because it slows us down. So this extends to any manager who is terrified of a slow pace when, in fact, the great majority of decisions that a manager has to make do not require extreme speed. It's entirely possible to still maintain high levels of productivity. In fact, we know that even in unionized environments, productivity does not go down. And most decisions don't require a breakneck pace. It's okay for 99% of decisions to be taken with the full consideration of the input of multiple people. And this broader diversity of input tends to increase the quality of decision-making in most contexts, in most decisions. So maybe we should just stop worrying about speed at all times. On occasion, you will have a moment when you will need to be very speedy, but it doesn't happen all that often.
And Julie, I'm going to flip that question around now for you. Does it hurt businesses in the long run, do you think, if employees don't have at least some level of power in the decision-making?
Well, it does. And let me tell you why, right? What we do know, and that has been documented by research, is that when workers have no control, when they cannot participate in the critical decisions that affect their daily lives, then that actually has detrimental effects on their health and on their well-being. It's actually been associated with job dissatisfaction, greater mental strain, and damaged physical health. And so, you know, companies obviously ought to care about their employees, their well-being, their health, if they want for them to be productive, to be happy to come to work, to want to contribute, to feel that they're proud to belong to this organization, then they should absolutely pay more attention to what they have to say. And in fact, in the context of the pandemic, we have reminders of that, I would say, daily, because think about the return to in-person work policies. Well, companies now across the country and across the world are getting to realize that obviously their employees have a perspective and they want to have a say and they want to be part of those decisions. And the companies that have been able to listen and engage in a constructive way have enhanced trust, which is so critical to the success of the companies. And if you're not able to enhance that trust, if you have a purely top-down approach, yes, your employees may comply, but they will not commit. And they may not want to continue working there because they're not going to be inspired by what they're going to find daily when they come to work.
We are talking to Julie Badalana and Tiziana Casciaro, authors of the book Power for All, How It Really Works, Why It's Everyone's Business. Looking at the workplace in particular now, they say American workplaces, employees don't really have much power at all, and they think that should change. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. That's 800-642-1234. Tiziana, a lot of your book looks at how people can try to carve out some power in different spheres in their lives, focusing on the workplace. What can employees do, do you think, to bring up this notion of power sharing and advance it, even if their employer isn't really thinking along those lines?
Well, there are many things that we can do individually, but when it comes to really reshaping who has power in large corporations, industries, and marketplaces, you have to often act in a coalition with others. So there is a joining of forces that has to occur. And my wonderful co-author, Julie, has developed a model that explains how you have to think about the different roles that have to be played in order for people to coalesce around a big change and not try to, reconfigure the power distribution all on their own. And that requires three things to happen. It requires agitation, innovation, orchestration. What does it mean? It means that you need somebody who brings the issue to the table. Agitation is the person, maybe the protester, the ones with a big voice that points out something that is wrong with the current state of affairs. But that is, alone is not enough. You have to also innovate and provide ideas, solutions to that problem that are pushing the issue forward. And that also is not enough. You also have to orchestrate by pulling together all the parties that have an interest in creating this change. And that requires organizational effort. And in the context of worker power, there are go-to initiatives that really create this coalition. Unions are the more well-known example. And it's not been very easy in the United States to unionize. The legal and the political environment has been incredibly difficult for unions to create a well-organized effort. And then there are other forms of coalescing, of creating a social movement. There are different models of the business. Cooperatives are a good example. Worker-owned cooperatives are an even more particular example, where you design the company so that the employees participate democratically in some of the choices, the critical choices that the company makes. These are things that require a movement, in a sense. It cannot be accomplished alone. And these are go-to mechanisms that have proven to be effective in making change happen.
We pick up our talk now with Julie Badalana and Tiziana Casciaro, authors of the new book, Power for All, How It Really Works and Why It's Everyone's Business. They're with us to talk about their ideas for giving workers more power in the workplace. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 to share an experience where maybe as an employee you felt like you did have a voice in decisions or you felt like you didn't. How did it feel? Either way. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. And let's go to your calls now. Eric is with us in Madison. Eric, hello.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm glad you are talking on this topic. I've got a little history to say on this. I was in a labor dispute at Checker Cab Company in town. And because we weren't getting our voices heard, we organized with the Wisconsin Industrial Garment Workers. They took us into their union. They felt sorry for us, I guess. But anyway, that strike that endured for 3 months eventually closed that company down and we all lost our jobs. But within a year, in 1979, October thereof, we had developed a worker-owned and operated cooperative and put 13 brand new cabs on the road. And we were up and running, and here we are all these years later. And I can gladly say I was there on day one.
Eric, thanks a lot for sharing that thought with us and that experience with us. Julie, what do you think? They had ultimately ended their old company and started a collectively run cab company of their own.
Well, thank you, Eric, for sharing your experience, because it says a lot about, you know, obviously how difficult this kind of work is. You talked yourself about the importance of organizing. And unions play a critical role, but you know, if workers want to have a say, you're right to point that they have to take their destiny in their hands and then get organized and together, as Tiziana mentioned, agitate, innovate, and orchestrate. And what you did is precisely that. You agitated and you took a risk, and that led to the outcome that you described. And then you were able to innovate and come up with this cooperative model, and you orchestrated the building of that model. So this is really important here, because what it's showing is that there are alternative models. And it is possible to make it work. And we need these models to be out there. We need to hear the voices of people who've developed these models, have succeeded, and are able to now really have new models of shared prosperity. Because this is what's needed today, if you think about it. We are facing a crisis that's not only a health crisis, but we're also facing an economic crisis that's characterized by rising inequalities on top of an environmental crisis. And so if we want to address all these crises at once, we all have to get together, right, to transform our economic and social systems. And I am actually very hopeful to know that so many workers want to be part of the change, and many companies want to be part of the change. And thanks to stories like Eric's and to innovative ways of organizing, we're not starting from scratch. We know that there are alternatives out there, and we know that we can share prosperity in novel ways and make sure that we end this cycle of increasing economic inequalities, because everyone is losing if we continue to increase the inequalities, not only the people who are at the bottom, but also the people at the top, because at some point the imbalances are so strong that then everyone will lose.
Eric, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jen with us in Waukesha. Jen, hello.
Hi. I just think that this is such an important topic. I'm kind of a Jill of all trades, and throughout my life I've worked in restaurants, manufacturing, retail, social services, and a common theme that I see is that employees get frustrated when they feel that the people who make decisions higher up the ladder are out of touch with what it takes for the ground workers to, you know, actually accomplish what needs to happen. And with more open communication between kind of the two factions, which is unfortunate that they tend to split in that way as it is, things could just run more smoothly, and people, I think in general, would just feel more valued. I mean, nobody wants to feel like they're just a worker answer a number that comes in to punch the clock day in and day out. They want to feel that no matter what they're doing matters, and that their insight as the people who are actually doing the work counts for something.
Jen, I got to ask, you've been at different workplaces and different kinds of jobs. Have you ever been in one where you felt like, yeah, they're getting it right? My input is being taken in consideration. It's making the job work better.
Where I work now, I do think that they are making a concerted effort. Other places, not really so much. And unfortunately, the lesser skilled work tends to, in my opinion, make employees feel basically disposable, you know, kind of a you can do it the way we want attitude, or we'll just find somebody else who does. But again, just, you know, the people who actually do the work are the ones that have the best ideas of, you know, ways to, grow more efficiency, mm-hmm. or, you know, just in general, a sense of camaraderie and well-being.
I gotcha, Jen. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Tiziana, I want to key in on that one point, Jen saying, hey, if you listen to the people on the ground doing the work, it can actually make it more efficient and more effective. What do you think of her lesson there?
I wanted to come out and hug Jen for what she said, because she's capturing the truth about what we know about how organizations work. The problem is that many in management roles believe that power is a zero-sum game, that if they have it, it means that somebody, they can control the behavior of others. And if they share it, they're going to lose it. And they miss completely overwhelming evidence in the research that autonomy increases performance. It increases it for the individual employee. It increases for a team. It increases for a division in an entire company. It increases for a company within a conglomerate. When you do what Jen was suggesting, to allow the people who are closer to the work itself to find better ways of doing what they do and have autonomous choice in how they carry out their functions, everybody's better off. But we need to educate management in understanding that this fear of losing control is absolutely misplaced. One of the things we try to do with this book is to provide the elements that allow somebody who is in a position of power to recognize that it is not a zero-sum game, that actually everybody benefits when you are a little bit more distributed in this decision-making power and autonomous behavior. So thank you, Jen, for bringing it up. And we hope that people who get access to these ideas will relinquish a little bit of this obsessive control over the behavior of employees, Jen, that really takes down everybody.
Thanks a lot for the call, Jen. Julie, I want to widen the scope a little bit in just a last minute or two. You talk about power more generally in your book. Can you leave us with some encouragement for people who might not think of themselves as having power or wielding power to think about the world in terms of power? Because that's part of the goal of your book, I think.
Absolutely. You know, Machiavelli, the Italian political philosopher, wrote his famous essay, The Prince, in the 16th century for a prince. And many of the people who've written and taught about power have been teaching and sharing information just in the spirit of explaining to people how to emulate the powerful people. We wrote this book about power for all. What we want to do is democratize access to knowledge about power. Power can be taught. And what we know from our research and experience is that once you understand the fundamentals of power, that power is just about control over access to valued resources, then you can understand the world around you, your workplace, what's happening in your neighborhood, in your community, in your country. You now have infrared glasses that can help you see the power relationships. And you also now can start thinking about what you can do to gain a measure of power. And then, as we discussed too, you can start thinking about, okay, maybe there is not much I can do alone, but what if we join forces? There's a lot we could accomplish together to change the existing power structures, to change the existing power hierarchies. And so this is precisely what we wrote the book. It's a book for everyone, including those who've been excluded from power and who think it's not for them. It is for everyone, and we need it to be for everyone, because if we want to really avoid power abuse, if we want to prevent power abuse in our organizations, in our society, in our personal life. The only way to prevent that power abuse is to not turn our back on power, is to embrace power as the energy we need to get anything done, and to make sure that we hold ourselves and those in power accountable for how we use our power and how they use their power. So I'm very hopeful that if people understand power and understand the role they have to play as members of their organizations, as citizens, we can together rise to the occasion and change our system within our organizations and within society. So I'm actually very hopeful.
We'll leave it there. Julie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Tiziana, thanks for being with us.
It was great being with you. Thank you so much.
That was Tiziana Casciaro and Julie Badalana. They were with us today to talk about a recent op-ed in the Washington Post on workers' power and the pandemic. And they've got a new book. It's out tomorrow. It's called Power for All: How It Really Works and Why It's Everyone's Business.